So welcome to the studio here.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
So I guess my first question, because I want to get a sense of when I first looked at the book, I think it's important to talk about the form because it's laid out interestingly. It's laid out, you know, when you encounter, say, a biography, it kind of wanders off into,
right,
you know, the history of the family, or you'll run into sort of a committee and then you'll find out a little bit of, you know, it kind,
right,
of has this branching quality. And I guess, you know, considering that the subject involves an area that is really filled with these, I mean, it involves roads and it,
yes,
involves area where there's not a lot of direct transportation routes. I wondered if that was kind of coincidental or whether that was something you had done intentionally.
Well, it wasn't so much, I see what you're saying. I don't think it was that I was trying to make the form of the book mimic a highway system in any way, but that's definitely true. And I once heard Robert Caro speak, and he's the author of The Power Broker, which is kind of the book on infrastructure. You know, he's the heavyweight. And I heard him speak in Austin, and he talked about writing that book. And he said it was like writing about a river. And in order to know a river, you have to explore all of its tributaries. You have to go, you know, up into every little creek and every little stream. And I by then had been deep into the research of this, and I definitely felt that was the case. It's what I was doing. And, you know, the other thing is that I worked for 10 years at The New Yorker, and I kind of have that narrative nonfiction style a little bit imprinted in my brain. I mean, so it was, you know, my heroes there, like Ian Frazier and John McPhee, this is what they do. You learn about, you know, John McPhee's written a book on oranges, and it's a subject that you might immediately not think is the most fascinating, but what they do is they find the fascinating facets to it. And in order to do that, I mean, for all the stuff that's in the book, there's just as much stuff that I wasn't able to put in.
Sure.
It was just, yeah.
And the this, again, because of this sort of rural territory that we're talking about, because all along the corridor there that it's described, it's, you know, very rural, you know, Shreveport, southern Indiana, I mean, southeastern Indiana, you can't really get any more sort of remote and in the lower 48.
Yeah.
And without going, like, very far west.
You haven't been to South Texas, I guess.
Yeah, South Texas. Yeah, fair enough. But one of the qualities that I think is difficult when you talk about that part of the country, that sort of middle corridor there, and it's been a problem for writers for a long time, even when you talk about somebody like Faulkner or you talk,
right,
about Sherwood Anderson, people describe it as nostalgic or, you know, they're romanticizing some kind of past.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for people who live in that area, when you encounter these towns and you encounter these places, they're not necessarily.
Exactly. Yeah.
They're not necessarily nostalgic.
It's not always romantic to the people there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering, I mean, do you have any thoughts on that? Because, you know, early on you described the scene of, you know, towns with high schools, with their football team's important, and they all,
right,
the whole town. And that's not a reminiscence. That's really the way that a lot of the towns along,
yeah,
this area of the country are.
Well, I think, you know, I wasn't like a New York Times reporter who parachuted in for 2 days to write about this story, where I had to kind of quickly give a feel for the place, but I didn't really have myself. I grew up in Indiana. My grandparents, to whom the book is dedicated, lived in Mooresville, which at the time was even more rural than it is now. And I went to school in Greencastle at DePauw and just loved driving around the small towns. I don't think I had any illusions. It wasn't, it was familiar territory to me, I guess is what I mean. And so I didn't want to fall into the trap of writing about, that you described, of writing about rural America in this kind of nostalgic, treacly way, because the whole point of the highway project and the reason people want it is because they want something bigger. And in order to introduce that idea and put yourself in the mindset of these people who, you know, the mayor of Dyersburg, Tennessee, who was mayor for 20 some odd years, he's very proud of his town. He loves his town. He won't ever live anywhere else. But he can also imagine a better future for it because, you know, while I might find it beautiful and bucolic and everything, the people there want jobs and they want a place to shop.
Okay, and this is kind of another interesting aspect of the whole discussion about I-69. Kind of, you know, we have a very narrow focus here.
Mm-hmm.
We know we talk a lot about southeastern Indiana, you know, Green, you know, Bloomfield, Linton,
right.
Swiss City, Evansville. But one of the interesting things about the whole project, and one of the things that I learned actually reading your book, is that both sides of this argument are homegrown,
mm-hmm.
in a sense.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's right.
The people, you know, there's this idea I think that people have that this is something being foisted from the outside.
Right, the man.
The man is coming in and building this highway. And I guess I'd be interested, you know, to sort of elaborate on that idea, because
yeah.
I don't think people here necessarily realize how homegrown this idea is. In fact, a lot of it originated here in Indiana.
That's right. I mean, the whole national corridor came out of a longstanding wish, and by longstanding I mean since the 50s, to connect Evansville and Indianapolis with an interstate. And they were frustrated about not being able to do that. And, you know, when you study, well, is it worth the cost to build a road between Evansville and Indianapolis? The answer was always no. But this economist named David Reed, who was working for the Hudson Institute on a study in southwestern Indiana back in 1990, had this brainstorm that basically, you know, if you want to build this road, you need federal dollars. And if you're going to get federal dollars, you need to connect it to other cities and other states and get those political leaders behind you and get the cost-benefit ratio to kind of jump. Because if you connect Memphis and Houston, then suddenly the potential commerce along that highway expands exponentially. But it all started in Washington. And even having that idea was not the end of the story. You don't just type that up and send it to Washington and they build you a highway. A man named David Graham had to get in his car and drive up and down where he imagined I-69 might go. And he literally just knocked on doors at the Chamber of Commerce in Shreveport and Houston and Memphis and found these people who were kind of taken with this idea.
Now, David Graham, you mentioned David Graham. He's actually from, I think you said, Washington, Indiana.
Yeah.
I mean, that's you know, this again, this there's this continual idea that this is not something that's necessarily coming from the outside. Can you talk a little bit about how some of the origins from within Indiana here, within the local communities, sort of in that part of the state?
You mean how they took the idea and worked with it, or?
Yeah, how it sort of originated down there. I mean, because, you know, David Graham sort of had this idea and he met with some people.
Oh, the background, yeah.
A little bit of the background, yeah.
Well, David Graham himself was. And this is, again, why I tell these stories, because you can explain that these guys got together and tried to build a highway, but that's not really satisfactory. Like, it doesn't make sense until you know about these people and their towns and how they feel. And David Graham, his very family history kind of led him to this moment of hearing about this highway and taking matters into his own hands. His father was Robert Graham, one of the Graham brothers who made automobiles in Evansville in the 20s, and Robert Graham was also the head of the Automobile Chamber of Commerce back in the 1920s and went to several of the international Pan-American Highway meetings. And that was a similar thing. You know, these people had a vision, and they organized, and they would have periodic meetings and talk about, well, how's it going in Panama? How's it going in, Mexico? And update each other. And the Mid-Continent Highway Coalition took this very much the same form. The states would get together and talk about where the road would go. But, you know, if David Reed had had this idea and told it to almost anybody else, it might have just vanished. It might have disappeared. And then David Graham told it, in turn, to a man in Shreveport named John Carruthers. And John Carruthers had just retired from being president of the Shreveport Chamber of Commerce. And he had helped his friend Senator Bennett Johnston cheer on the improvement of the Red River. So he had been involved in a big infrastructure project, had a sense of what was required and that it could be done if you had the proper political muscle. So, I mean, this thing, Interstate 69 could have easily not happened. And for years it didn't, when it was just a road to Evansville. But this series of events that is just completely, you know, one person who was perfectly suited to carry the idea forward to another got it into federal legislation.
Okay. And from sort of a broader perspective, again, because we don't have, again, we're very focused
mm-hmm.
here. And so we don't have, we, you know, in Indiana, there's not a lot of sense of how other communities that are along this route, along this corridor, are what their experience of this whole I-69 process is. And it's kind of interesting, too, because if you look at I-69, there's sort of a segment of it built in Mississippi. I think there's like very, very small in Tennessee.
Yeah.
And then the existing portion. So it, a lot of the money has already been spent, but it's not, the highway has not actually materialized
right.
along this route.
Well, you have to spend a lot of money just to study the idea of a highway and to put it through all the environmental studies. Those environmental studies, by the way, happened because of a man who lived in Bloomington, Linton Caldwell, who I think helped, was instrumental in forming SPIA. Mm-hmm. And he wrote the National Environmental Policy Act, or helped write it. And in his mind, this was signed in the early 70s by President Nixon. In his mind, he was basically changing the philosophy of government and saying, whenever we do a dam, whenever we do a road, whenever we do some big project, we need to think about the environment. But in effect, what he did, and Linton Caldwell lamented this until his death, was that he essentially created a process and not an outcome. I mean, he created a process where you had to do these studies, but then when different projects went to court, the courts found that, well, really, all the law required was the process. You have to do these studies. And Indiana, you know, the Tokarskis and other opponents were always flabbergasted that this huge stack of paper, this document, could say that what the state wanted to do was the most expensive and the most environmentally destructive, and yet they could do it anyway. And that's because the environmental laws don't stop you from destroying the environment. They just make you jump through hoops on the way there. But it's true that along a lot of the route, the attitudes are very different, and I think other parts of the country are a little hungrier. It's, you know, in the Mississippi Delta, for instance, the farms are much bigger. They're a little more corporate. To them, to lose a section of your farm that you can then develop is not necessarily a sad story. But here, the farms tend to be smaller. They tend to be family farms, and people are feel differently about them.
Okay. One thing that I found fairly interesting was actually you made a number of connections to the original interstate highway plan, and not just on a grand scale. One of the parts that I found actually particularly interesting was you repeatedly had talked about the fact that when you encountered people who were strongly in support of I-69, that they grew up in a different age.
Right.
They grew up in an age when I think you used the term, you know, for say a later generation, use the term post-interstate.
Mm-hmm.
They grew up in the auto age. I mean, they grew up when a car was what you had. I mean, you drove and you were expected to drive, and that was very much
right.
So,
the interstates were the future mm-hmm. for these men.
And I guess that's kind of an interesting thought because, you know, here's this project. But a lot of discussion going on across the country now is not really about interstates in terms of, I mean, there's a lot of now talk about rail,
right.
Light rail systems and things like that. And yet there's this still persistent talk about Interstate 69. So I guess I'm kind of interested, you know, I mean, do you view this as sort of a holdover or?
Oh, it's definitely a holdover. I think if this were proposed today, it would be shot down very quickly. There are, you know, here and there, if this was just Indianapolis building a new loop or Houston building a new loop or Memphis building a new loop, but this is all of those. I mean, Indianapolis, the loop was proposed, but seems to no longer be happening. But, you know, this is all of those plus all of the connective highway. It's just a huge project. And I think that if it weren't so far along, it would probably be cast aside, at least by this administration. So, you know, the Obama administration is now focused on livability, they call it, which means, you know, making towns and cities a more friendly place for pedestrians and bicyclists. And they point out that our population is aging. The AARP is really big into this now. Basically, you know, our seniors are not going to want to be driving everywhere. They want to be able to walk to the theater and the restaurant and the grocery store. So you're right. The philosophy is definitely shifting. It seemed to be ready to shift for quite a while, in 1991, the same year, ironically, that Interstate 69 made it into the federal law, that same bill declared an end to the interstate system, which is why it's been so hard to fund Interstate 69, and it's why Interstate 69 is such a weird, you know, unique project.
Yeah. You ended on funding there, and that's kind of almost a story in and of itself.
Yes.
Because there's been just, I mean, over and over, you know, if it was $7 million or $7 billion, $2 billion, $24 billion, and not only just the number, but the sort of mechanisms that are have been proposed over the years. You know, I mean, even at one point, I think you mentioned that they had considered trying to levy almost donations from local businesses to support this. That's such a complex issue in and of itself. I guess how do you approach a subject like that when you're sort of looking at it? Because there's such a story just within that sort of funding.
Yeah. Well, the overall point is that the funding mechanism we're used to and that we think is sacrosanct and the only way to do it is only 50 years old. So in 1956, along with the interstate system, that federal aid highway bill created the Highway Trust Fund. And it said all the gas taxes and all these other vehicle-related fees would be pooled together and that we were going to use this money as the federal government was going to redistribute this money to the states to build the interstate system. That will no longer be the way we do things, most likely, because we have two national priorities. One is to build infrastructure, and one is to reduce the burning of gasoline. You can't do both of those things under the current system. So it's broken. And there's a lot of talk right now about what will replace it. And I can go into all of that. But the interesting thing is that as I looked at the history of the interstate system and the history of road building and even railroads and pre-automobile roads, the ways that we have built infrastructure in this country has been wildly variant. And we've swung like a pendulum between public and private. The first roads, you know, I think under Thomas Jefferson, we started building the National Road, the Road West, and the Erie Canal was a great public project. But the Erie Canal happened instead of the project with using the Potomac, which George Washington wanted to build, and he had formed a private company to do so. Many of our highways, you know, the term turnpike comes from the carriage days when someone would have a toll booth and a pike, a pole across the road, and would turn it to let you through after you paid the toll. And then the railroads, of course, were private companies, and they built things for profit, and the government paid them to do so by giving them land, which they then built towns on. So the idea of a private company, you know, this came up in Texas, the Trans-Texas Corridor. Actually, the idea of a private company building a piece of infrastructure and recouping that investment by tolling and building and doing land development, that's just what we did with the railroads, you know, 150 years ago.
Okay. And this is kind of the final question, but I guess, you know, it's a specific – I mean, I-69 is not necessarily a topic that immediately jumps as being a matter of some interest to, say, somebody in New York or somebody California or somebody or even in Chicago, for example. I'm wondering, I mean, I know you're from Indiana, but I was just wondering how you know, what was the process of deciding to pick this topic even in the first place as a subject for a book and then to spend so much time on it.
Right.
Sort of researching.
Well, it kind of grabbed me. I kind of got obsessed with it. So I guess it's the same story of anyone's little mini obsession. But the reason why I got so interested in it, I am from Indianapolis. My dad, 10 years ago, moved to Houston. And I'd been to Mississippi to write for the magazine The Oxford American about blues bars, which was a pretty fun assignment. But I heard about I-69 in three totally different contexts in those three places. And I started doing research. You know, I had a Google alert that sent me every single article about I-69. And the variety of perspectives and the variety of places that would be affected and how they thought they might be affected struck me as a chance to write both a regional portrait of these places, but also the story of infrastructure. I mean, infrastructure is a good story. Transportation is a good story. It affects our lives in ways you don't realize until you sort of stop and think about it. I mean, the location of cities, the health of the economy, the shape of our landscape, the shape of our communities, all of that is really determined by transportation. And the more I learned about it, the more I realized this, and it made me want to kind of decode it. And at the same time, I noticed that all these articles I was reading dealt only with the local area. So when I read an Indianapolis Star article, it didn't talk about Texas or Mississippi. And when I read something in the Houston Chronicle, it didn't talk about Indiana. So, and as I reported, the people I was interviewing would ask me questions about what was going on elsewhere in the country. So those things kind of clued me into the idea that I was doing something that was of value. I mean, putting together the whole story.
All right. Excellent. Thank you very much. I appreciate you being here.
Great to be here. Thanks. All right.